will be called on to operate very quickly and suddenly, both in peacetime and wartime, and therefore it must have the capacity in under those conditions to operate flat out. But if you're going to be there, what do you need in peacetime? And what you need in peacetime is not far removed from what you need in the emergency. That being the case, how do you use it in peacetime? And so we evolved the business of flying all the troops overseas, of doing all the logistic support of Europe by air, as opposed to all the ships that yeah. we've been doing. And we evolved this whole policy, and it was a fundamental change in our whole thinking, because it resulted in such things as the Army no longer thought in terms of rotating their people to Europe by sea. And once that hit the fan, the shipping companies were up in Ottawa. Boy, what hammering about the loss of business, and it would mean another ship going off the Atlantic, and oh dear. But it was that kind of fundamental thinking that went on. And then we had to tie in the airplanes. Where should they be located? What kind of communication system did we have to have? Just as an example, we got into the single sideband requirement, so we could talk to our airplanes wherever they were, literally in the world, we hoped. What about the ground environment to support that? And then we came up with a concept of what we call the air movements units, and they're still in existence today. This whole system is still yeah. still standing the test, and yeah. still operates today the way it was devised in that 6-week period in my office back about 61, I guess it was.
Yeah.
But when we had to determine the number of people that were involved, the training program, we said if we're going to be expected to go anywhere in the world, which is now we had now convinced ourselves that we were going to be doing this, so
yeah.
If we were, then we had to have training flights. We had to have people out across the world so they get to know some of these places, mm-hmm. find out about them before we were suddenly in there in an operation as much as it was possible. So we then talked about round-the-world training flights. And, oh, Jesus, it was big stuff compared to what we had been doing in the past. It was enormous. And it was so big that I didn't think it would be bought. I really didn't. I thought that it would. We had perhaps gone a little bit too far.
Yeah.
But again, damn it, the thing went to the Air Council. And I suppose, like any paper that's had a lot of good thought put into it, and a lot of work,
yeah.
The whole thing was so logical that while they hiccuped over several things, they couldn't come up with the alternate or the other way of doing it.
Yeah.
And then in the final analysis, the whole thing was accepted. The whole killaboo. And again, that was just great, because it was a lot of work, and to have the thing accepted without modification, was an enormous flip. And aside from that, we were delighted, because we realized that for the first time we had a properly thought through transport concept that would stand the test, at least we're sure it would. And it has. It's been tried operationally many, many times, and it's stood up. So that was one of the last things I did, because it was soon after that, a little while after that, that I was called into an Air Council meeting, and there'd been some icky item on the agenda, and I thought, oh boy, here I go, you know, I'm for the high jump or something like that. And sure enough, Campbell had a queer sense of humor. He loved to take a mickey out of people. On the other hand, if somebody did a good job, he'd always write a note afterwards and say that was a damn fine briefing or a damn fine effort and so forth.
Yeah.
Just a little scribble note. And he called me in, and God, he started to climb aboard me about something, and I was there, and I just sat there. I thought, God, what the hell is he talking about? And then after, he teed off on me. He said, but that's not the point. The real reason why we got you in here is to tell you that you're going to be the new air officer commanding Air Transport Command. You've done all the bloody planning on the concept. Now we're going to let you go down and put the thing together and make it work.
So, I'll be there.
So I said, well, of course, that I grinned like crazy, because finally, after all those years, I was going to get out of the Air Force headquarters.
Yeah.
And I hoped away from all those dreadful long hours that we put in. Long, long hours, and not seeing the family. Mind you, I didn't go from the frying pan into the fire, but when I did get to Transport Command, as I'll point out later, it was almost as bad in terms of time away, but there wasn't that enormous pressure, and you weren't constantly meeting deadlines that were, again, a little to show Campbell what he was like. He called me on the intercom one day, and he said, what's the answer to so-and-so? And I can't remember what the item was at the time, but what's the answer? And I had been having some run-ins with him, and I knew what he was like. And so I thought, well, Jesus, I may as well get, here we go again. I said, well, now what do you want? Do you want a one-minute answer? Do you want a 30-minute answer so I can call in a couple of staff? Or do you want a 24-hour answer, and we'll do a proper paper on it. We'll work on it tonight and give you the proper, the full answer tomorrow night. He said, I've got to go down and see the chief. I want an answer right now. And I said, all right, it's going to be off the top of my head, and I'm going to give you a one-minute answer. So I gave him a one-minute answer. Of course, I immediately called the staff in, because I knew he was down in the minister's office, and checked it out, and I was right.
Yeah.
I was right. So I let it go. Well, from there on, every time he called me, as he did, and he bypassed the vice, which was not right. He should have gone through the vice, but he would bypass the vice and come straight to me. And I would say, sir, do you want a one-minute answer or a five-minute answer? And he always laughed. He'd say, no, no. Let me have a paper on it tomorrow morning or something like that. But we got to, we had a yeah. good rapport going
yeah.
that was, it helped me enormously, because I have seen him almost be very, very tough on people. And he was a hard taskmaster. But I was fortunate. I got along with him, and he never, that was the one and only time he really teed
yeah.
off on me.
Yeah.
And,
very neat.
Yes, yeah. So I think there, that we stop with that one, unless there's anything else you have on plans that we can then move on to
no,
air
transport. No, there'll be a little bit more, but there's just one or two things I have in my mind. But I think
okay.
this is a good point to stop at this one, and we'll okay. bash on the other side of the tape and go into transport command
yeah,
next
fine.
Time. No,
plus any questions you might have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the date is October the 10th, 1978. This is an interview of Lieutenant General Lane by Reg Roy. One of the things that you mentioned only casually, and I can appreciate you mentioning it only casually, and of course that's intelligence. Now, there's various shapes and forms, Reg, of intelligence, as you know. Internal, external, ours, theirs, and all the rest of it. What was your particular task with respect to intelligence? What sort of intelligence were you seeking? Let's put it that way.
Well, firstly, it was air intelligence,
mm.
as opposed to land or sea intelligence.
Mm.
So it was my responsibility to advise the Air Council and up the line to the Chiefs of Staff on air intelligence of foreign nations. Now, by foreign, I do not include such things as the United States or close allies.
Mm-hmm.
There would be no... We did not, for example, keep an intelligence section going on the United States Air Force, nor the RAF. But foreign meaning certainly the Iron Curtain countries,
mm-hmm.
and information on all other the other nations, such as South America, any outfit, Israel, any outfit that had an air force.
Mm.
But of course, the concern there was pretty minimal. It was almost a bookkeeping type of thing, unless something untoward happened. If there was a threat of an outbreak somewhere or a civil war, and the Air Council wanted a briefing on what the heck was going on, then the Director of Air Intelligence would put together a briefing, and it would be presented to the Air Council at their weekly meeting or something like
mm-hmm.
that. In other words, a special meeting. So we had to have enough intelligence in which we could put together briefings on all foreign air forces. But the great effort went on in the USSR.
Mm-hmm.
That was where most of the intelligence was concentrated.
Well, we would rely a great deal, not entirely necessarily, but surely a great deal on American, British.
Absolutely.
Sources.
Because it has never been Canada's policy to have covert intelligence. Never. It has come up in the House two or three times when opposition have accused the government of having spies, the cloak and dagger type of organization. And of course, the government has always said, no way. And they're right.
Yeah.
They never have. They have not, to my knowledge, even. When one thinks in terms of the RCMP is a domestic intelligence organization. It's not a foreign intelligence
yeah.
organization. And external affairs were very, very careful in what they did in the way of collecting intelligence, raw intelligence from foreign embassies. I think a good the way you can judge that is how often do we have we had persona non grata, an accused of spying. The only time it's ever happened is if we've caught somebody and it's been a return in kind type of thing. But you're absolutely right. We relied an enormous amount on the United States and Great Britain for the most of our intelligence. Mm-hmm. And they were good. There is no two ways about it. The intelligence we were getting from both the RAF and the USAF was excellent stuff. But it was all done on a joint basis. Mm-hmm. We pool the information.
Wouldn't it be in your period too, Range, that more and more intelligence is coming from the spy in the sky?
No, that hadn't started. No, that hadn't started.
Yeah.
I don't mean the satellites hadn't started, but the actual development of systems for space surveillance had not been devised. They were still pretty small vehicles in those days. And the bigger vehicles, the technology wasn't quite there at that time.
Yeah.
It was to come later. But the intelligence, we used to have Joint Intelligence Committee that had representation on it from External Affairs and the other armed forces in the RCMP. So that our intelligence, while we were primarily in the air side, we were primarily concerned with foreign intelligence. Through this joint committee, we were brought up to speed on intelligence of an internal nature.
Yeah.
Because the RCMP and the Army were always very concerned about internal security and intelligence. Intelligence is perhaps too strong a word, because it was more a question of keeping a dossier or keeping information on any of the Marxist groups and the Communist Party. I have to be careful, because the RCMP have always played their intelligence close to the chest, as we can witness right now with the McDonald Commission, how difficult it is to get any information out from them.
Yeah.
And even in committee, they would never disclose how they got any information. They would come up and say, "Well, here is the information we have."
Yeah.
And if you went to try to go any further, they would say, "Sorry, we would rather not discuss that."
Yeah.
And they were, in other words, they did have covert operators, as we folks know. They've had it in the drug business. They've infiltrated some of these very extreme leftist organizations.
Yeah.
They have infiltrated. And that is a real covert type of operation, which, of course, Canada has never done externally or internationally, but has done it internally. So
I've heard it said by some people whose word I would tend to accept, that about 80 to 85% of the information you're seeking is available.
Oh, yes,
world.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, if we get back to the external, or the international intelligence, the Directorate of Air Intelligence, I built up into quite a large organization, because we had some very, very capable people, analysts.
Mm-hmm.
And intelligence analysts are a queer bird. I don't know what it is, but there's just something about them. That they can take a whole pile of periodicals, documents, speeches, and what have you, and somehow or other they glean stuff out of all of those, and it clicks. And the first thing you know, it's all put together, and they have put together something which, if I was to read all those various pieces, it would pass right over my head. I would miss this very glaring, and when you do see what they can do, say, "My God, of course, how did I miss that?"
Yeah.
A lot of intelligence comes from that.
Yeah.
And we did get some intelligence from our attachés, our air attachés and our other attachés, but it was, again, very limited, because the government policy was not to go underground, and an air attaché, of course, was not supposed to be a spy of the cloak and dagger, the felt hat and the dark coat type of thing. But we did have people, some of our attachés were very, very good, and in their traveling around, kept their wits about them, and the one case that was an excellent one of what a good man can do, the Canadian air attaché got the first photograph of the new Russian bomber that was a follow-on to the Badger. And we knew it was being developed. I say we, the intelligence community in the West knew it was being developed. But no one had any idea what it looked like, what size it was, nothing. Now, space photography hadn't come along, no problem. And this boy was out and just managed to slip his tail and went by one of the research airfields outside Moscow, and my God, lo and behold, there wasn't this bloody airplane on it. And so, of course, very quickly he took some photographs, kept going, didn't stop, kept moving, got back to Moscow, shot the film over, didn't even dare develop it in the embassy, shot it right over in the bag. We got it, and of course the intelligence, my organization just about fell over themselves, because the photographs were superb, they were excellent, they're beautiful. Well, we let Washington know right away, and Washington were up within 24 hours, they had a whole team up. And we had already started the technical analysis of this bird.
Yeah.
And this was the next thing, to try and to determine what was this bird capable of, and what was the size, and all the technical bits. And we had people who were capable of doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And now that is getting into the real nitty-gritty of intelligence. That's taking a photograph and developing, from that photograph, getting raw intelligence turned into facts and figures that are of real value to the intelligence community. And then can be used by the operators, and it's translated into a threat.
Yeah.
So on it goes.
No.
That was probably the highlight of intelligence gathering while I was in the shop, because it really did. It hit the fan. That was a great thing.
Neat.
It was a scoop, if you will, a real scoop in the intelligence world.
Did the fellow get the OBE or something?
No, he didn't. He just got a thank you very much. We had, it was awfully difficult. We had other attachés who were beaten up. They would be followed on a train or something like this, and then by God, the goon squad would move in and muss them up. We had one who was quite badly beaten up.
For taking a photograph?
No, just searched and roughed up because they felt that it was a threat. It was a way of compromising, if you will, an attaché.
Yeah.
So that he would, God, he'd think twice before he did anything where that would really smack of spying. It was being convicted before you were caught, convicted and sentenced before you were caught, because the USSR organization, KGB, worked on the simple basis that anytime an attaché left Moscow, he obviously was spying. He was out, not on a holiday, he was out to see what he could get.
Yeah.
And if any of the routes went near any airfield or any military installation, and then, of course, this is why he took that route, so he could get some photographs, whatever. So they were always searching people when they traveled outside like that. They'd move into a train carriage and go right through all the gear, and if there were any cameras, just take the film out, period. And it didn't make any difference whether it was a holiday or not.
Even though he would have diplomatic
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, yes, sure, absolutely. And rough them up, too. Just rough them up. There were a couple of cases. One, a Brit was traveling with a Canadian. He was a squadron leader, and he was very badly beaten up. The Canadian was roughed up, and the two of the goons literally sat on the Canadian while the rest of them worked this poor squadron leader over as something fierce. And the Canadian, just nothing he could do except be bloody thankful that he wasn't the object of that particular attack. It was the squadron leader. Now, why they picked on him, of course, we don't know. But they gave him an awful working over. Now, there was a diplomatic complaint made.
Oh,
but those must have been some uncontrollable element in our society who were traveling on the train, and they were probably looking for booze or money or something like that. Well, they weren't, because they didn't touch anything like that. It was film, camera, and that sort of thing. So that for an attaché who legitimately was not expected to do any underground work or to stick his neck out in that sense.
Yeah.
He was there to attend those official functions where he was invited to go, even down to the May Day parade sort of thing.
Yeah.
But he was an official observer. Or when they did take, as they did very, very rarely, but they did do, invite some attachés to go out into the countryside to visit some airfield or something like that for a very innocuous and very unimportant event from an intelligence point of view. But they did that because, so we would respond in kind. We would invite the attachés, but we weren't quite so smart. We would then take them onto all of our bases and show them things, or not show them things, and take them there, and any good observer would notice stuff and spot stuff and so forth.
Yeah.
But when we went through this period of these boys being threatened, roughed up, it acted as a deterrent to...
Didn't we retaliate in kind?
No,
not in kind, but not mushing them up, but restricting them at least.
Oh, yes, well, yes, we restricted them. Sure. During that time period, none of the attachés were allowed to leave Ottawa without a special clearance.
Yeah.
No, they were confined to Ottawa. And but we weren't that tough on them. If they came in and said they wanted to go to Toronto or they wanted to go to Vancouver, I was not the one who was granting the authority because it was external affairs.
Yeah.
I mean, I knew it was going on.
Yeah.
But to my knowledge, I don't know that external affairs refused what could be described as a legitimate request to travel. If they suddenly said, we want to go to Cold Lake, near the range, or about Cartier, or any place where there was a research establishment, then obviously they would be refused.
What about the other side of the coin? Do you ever have any, Russian women trying to vamp people?
No, nothing like that. No, they didn't have to, because the Russians were great hosts, and they loved to entertain, and they loved to drink.
Yeah.
And we were constantly, all of the staff, were constantly being invited to Iron Curtain Country cocktail parties, dinners, and we had to set a roster up so that all invitations would be registered, and then there was a little organization set up to determine who would and who would accept and who would go. And when they did, then they were expected to report back immediately what happened.
Yeah.
And it was very often, and it was a question of sitting down to a steady drinking, and then the questions would start. And try and work into it, and working on the booze. But our people were all well briefed, and to my knowledge, were always one step ahead. It was patently obvious what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
So although I know one or two of them started to have a little bit of fun and began to drop the bits of information which were absolutely, utterly useless, but sounded plausible at the time.
Yeah.
And they would report this, and then you'd find that they wouldn't be invited back again. As soon as they checked out, they realized that they were being taken.
Yeah.
But other than that, no, there was no the so-called KGB organization in Ottawa. While undoubtedly it was there, I think they worked more, perhaps on either the civilian or the civil servant, who perhaps might have access to information.
Yeah.
But it was not. We never had anything. We never had any trouble in our organization.
Yeah.
And they had to be careful, too, because they suddenly found, for example, we had one civilian, a boy by the name of George Kalloff, who was extremely good and an intelligent man, civilian, extremely good. And they should have realized from his bloody name, but of course he could speak Russian fluently. And he always implied that he couldn't speak Russian, or... Whenever they started to speak Russian, he would sort of look up and sort of say, "Oh, excuse me, what did you say?" kind of thing in English. And he once or twice came back with little gems, but then they caught on. Then they suddenly realized that George did very well. He went along. No, was it George or somebody else? I had another person in the organization. Now, what the hell was it? The Russians sent. The Russians sent trade commission to Canada. And it was, they were going to travel quite a long way. And they had to have a so-called coordinator, administrative coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
And we put, who the hell was it? Put this other lad in as the coordinator. And he spoke fluent Russian.
Mm-hmm.
But again, played it absolutely cold and looked after their bags and would break in on any discussion they were having in their rooms to say, now here are the arrangements for tomorrow. And quite often, and then they would keep on talking. See, well, he would say, now is there anything you need in the way of drinks and so on. And he picked up quite a bit of information, by eavesdropping. Just the way that. But those opportunities were very rare. And nothing.
Yeah, fairly simple stuff.
World-shaking ever came out of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But other than that, the other thing I learned, though, and I still feel, and of course I know, and when I was at NORAD, it became even, it impressed me even more, and that is American intelligence. The intelligence organization of the United States is incredible.
Yeah.
It is incredible, right? When I'm speaking, and I have spoken, and people have said, what about the information that you're giving us? How do we know that they have X number of missiles? And I would then say, in reply, well, I can't tell you how we know specifically, but let me put it this way. I have the greatest confidence in the intelligence of the United States. When they say there is 1,314 missiles, you bet your bottom dollar that there are 1,314 missiles.
Well, on the other hand, though, Reg, they can make boo-boos like you wouldn't believe.
Yes, but I think we have to differentiate here between collecting intelligence, or raw intelligence, and interpretation.
Yeah.
Which is a different story.
Yeah, true enough.
But the raw intelligence, the raw data, is there. Now it's how you take that information and what you do with it, how you put it into an intelligence précis of on any given thing.
Yeah.
And where you really get into trouble. No, that's not the way to put it. Where it becomes extremely difficult, and you of course have the chance of making great error, is taking intelligence and trying to translate that into intention.
Yeah. What are they going to do with it?
What are they going to do with it?
With what they have.
That's right. Because you really can't be sure until you pick up something in the way of an op order or some executive action.
Yeah.
Now, you may have felt all along that this was what was going to happen, but until that actually occurred, you're never sure. So intention is where it becomes extremely difficult. And this is where you can argue with anyone. And this is why it makes it so difficult when appearing before things like parliamentary committees. You get somebody who's very anti the military, say you take one of the NDP members or something like this, and he can take some of that so-called released basic intelligence and put a quite different interpretation on it.
Yeah.
And rightly so, too.
Yeah.
And you have no way, you have no way of saying he is wrong unless it's after the fact. And if it happens to be a serious thing, after the fact, ain't any good any longer.
Yeah,
it's too bad, too late.
What about the other side of the coin, or at least the edge of the coin, shall we say, thinking of your period, Russian defectors?
We would never have anything to do with that.
You wouldn't?
No. That would be handled entirely by the RCMP and External Affairs, and we would never get involved in that. Now, I don't know whether, to my knowledge, I don't think the Army ever got involved, but let me just stop for a minute. Let me try to think. I don't remember a defector at that time. And I'm going through a period from 58 through to about 62, 4-year period. And I don't remember a defector at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there may have been. But certainly, it doesn't stick in my mind that there was one. And certainly, I don't remember a specific effort in terms of interrogation or trying to get information from a defector that would have been any value to the air intelligence side.
Well, now, of course, another way, and one hears about this, I don't know where your offices were, you know, what wing, A, B, or C
building. Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But what about the possibility of agents with these long-range microphones that could pick up a conversation through a window, this, that, and the other thing? Did you have any...
No, we... Where real intelligence was discussed, they were always inside rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And if it had to be on an outside, as it happened, and as it was in the Air Intelligence Organization itself, they had outside windows. They were all blacked out completely. It was just like living in a goddamn dungeon, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
So, and they were constantly, at least internally, we were constantly sweeping for bugs and so forth.
Did you ever find one?
No.
No.
But the other one too was that caused a bit of a furor at the time too was the Russians had put up some aerials, some microwave aerials on the embassy, and we've found out that the communications net from Ottawa, or from NDHQ, if you will, to I think it was to Montreal. Passed right slap bang, the chute went slap over the embassy, and there was great concern that they were intercepting, but of course everything was in code anyway, and if they were intercepting, and we have every reason to suppose that they were, the question was, could they break the code? And anything of that nature, it's one-time code, and that's it.
Yeah.
You use it once, and it's finished.
Yeah.
So that breaking down codes becomes a very difficult job. And we were before the days of the computer.
Mm-hmm.
By that, I mean using computers that were sophisticated enough to assist in code breaking.
Yeah.
So, no, we were never really too worried about spying of that nature. We were more concerned about, and it was always a great concern, a top secret document suddenly being misplaced.
Yeah.
Somebody carrying one in a briefcase, going from one headquarters to another, something like that, and leaving his briefcase in a restaurant, or that kind of thing, which it happened two or three times. Yeah. I'd say a restaurant, wherever it might be, a washroom, something like that.
Yeah.
And God, talk about putting the fear of God into you, because the compromise of information possibly when that happened was enormous. But again, it seemed that every time things were recovered, and it would appear without anyone having real knowledge of what the hell they had their hands on.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank God.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that was a greater concern.
Yeah.
It was the mistakes created by our own people rather than by